Hello everyone, it is I, McSullivan. I am bringing you good news. March 3rd is the anniversary of the Kentucky Meat Shower. You know, that weird event from 1876 that I wrote a book about, and I also did an episode way back when about as well. Well, I'm going to read that book live on YouTube Live, as I've done for the last few years. It's a very fun day. We're going to do it on March 3rd at 5 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. It's a Sunday. Just a Sunday evening. I'm going to be live on camera with the book, and I'll act goofy, I guess. Probably. I don't know. We'll see what happens. But I'll read the book, and we'll talk about the meat shower, and we'll all ponder what a strange occurrence that really was. I'd love it if you would join me. It's always been a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to it. So, you can find the link on the website, thepastandthecurious.com, either on the meat shower tab or halfway down the homepage. Or you can just go to thepastandthecurious.com/themeatshower, or you can just find my YouTube page and it will be there as well. So, March 3rd, I'll see you, or you'll see me. I probably won't be able to see you. Anyway, looking forward to it!
Calling all trivia nerds, Brittany here, and I host the Family Road Trip Trivia Podcast with my best friend Meredith. Is your next car ride looking like a snooze fest? We've got the cure. Three rounds of awesome trivia every week. Harry Potter, Disney, science, sports, you name it. No more silent car troubles. The Family Road Trip Trivia Podcast. Connect, laugh, and learn with your kids, big and small. New episodes every week wherever you get your podcasts. Search for the Family Road Trip Trivia Podcast.
You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Well, howdy do, y'all. It's Mick Sullivan, and this is The Past and the Curious. And, you know, look, I was thinking, and you know what's great? Libraries. Libraries are awesome. I'm telling you, this is the honest truth. I couldn't do this show without my library card. It is such an amazing thing. Libraries are, and have always been, such an amazing part of our community. And I hope everybody there, listening on the other end of this podcast, uses their library. Go to the library this weekend. Go read a book. See what else they've got. They've got all sorts of resources online, too. So I wanted to do a library episode because I love them so much. That's what this episode is about. The first story is about Anne Carroll Moore. You'll learn plenty about her. There's a lot more to learn if you want to dig into her story, though. You can find all sorts of resources. And also, the Western Library, which happens to be in my hometown of Louisville, Kentucky, and it is a great story. But before we start the show, just want to say, I hope to see you in Boston on April 20th, 2024, at the WBUR Podcast Festival. I'm pretty excited. Anyway, let's get started with the show. No one is perfect. You're human. I'm human. All the grown-ups in your life are human. So is the garbage collector, the bank teller, your teacher, even the hairstylist. It's good to accept that we're all human. There's good and there's bad and there's mistakes and successes. And I'm not just talking about haircuts. And yet, through it all, we try to give each other the grace that we deserve. The woman in this story is most certainly also human. But to many, she brings up some really big feelings. Some people love her. Some people, do not. Some even consider her a villain of sorts. But others thank her for changing our world. So was she a politician? An artist? A civil rights leader? No, not exactly. She was a children's librarian. Not just any librarian, mind you. Anne Carroll Moore is considered to be the first true, or at least the most important, early children's librarian in American history. From her self-made position of power, she changed the way that Americans thought about kids in libraries. But she also used her power to influence what was considered a good children's book. And let's put it this way. There's a pretty good chance that she would have rejected your favorite children's book and kept it off of the shelves. In her day and age, Anne's yes or no could make or break a book. For decades, her opinion was the most powerful opinion when it came to children's literature, and it was the only opinion that mattered as far as she was concerned, which is where a lot of people draw the line and stop celebrating her legacy. When Anne Carroll Moore was born in 1871 in Limerick, Maine, kids were not allowed in libraries. That wasn't just a state of Maine thing, that was an everywhere thing. Children were not welcome in pretty much any library. In some cases, there were stringent rules, like only boys over 14 could enter. But for decades, it was believed that kids couldn't be trusted to check out books, and they didn't really need access to them anyway. But even more so, pretty much everywhere, no one in a library wanted noisy kids coming in and disrupting their dignified patrons with their loud requests for silly fiction books for young people. Ugh! As Anne grew up in Maine, she was the youngest child in her family, surrounded by her seven older brothers who called her Shrimp. If that was an unkind nickname, or a somewhat endearing nickname, I'm not sure. But it wasn't all bad. She had her own horse, and she really enjoyed hearing her father read to her. She grew very close to her father, and originally had hoped to follow in his footsteps as a lawyer. This was a very difficult field for a woman to work in the 1800s, and sadly, her studies would prove too difficult to continue as a young woman after both of her parents died just a few days apart. But around this time in America, it's the 1890s to be clear, there were tremendous developments in providing education and other essential services to Americans, especially kids. For example, kindergarten was new and growing in popularity, and there seemed to be libraries popping up left and right. And in a sense, there were. A really, really rich guy named Andrew Carnegie had pledged much of the fortune that he made in the steel industry to build libraries in communities that needed them. Between 1889 and 1929, he funded 2,509 libraries around the world. Over 1,600 of those were in America. All of those libraries needed librarians. But, for the most part, there was one thing they didn't need. Kids.
Hit the road, kiddos. Books are for grown-ups. Why don't you go play in the street?
Luckily, around this time, things were starting to change. In 1894, at a meeting of the American Library Association, a discussion began.
Here's a wild idea. Just go with me for a minute. What if we let kids into libraries? Would everything come crashing down? If that doesn't sound good, maybe we could, you know, build a separate room for the kids. Maybe they could even enter through a side door or the back door, just so patrons aren't terrorized by the horrifying sight of children in a library. And if we did, maybe we could also make an effort to understand what kids like to read and what they might like to read. And then we could put some of those books on the shelves in this separate children's wing. And one last thought. Maybe we should find a few librarians who maybe actually like kids? Is that crazy? If this seems far-fetched, just say so.
Well, Anne loved the idea. She had studied to be a librarian through the Pratt Institute, and in 1896, she was put in charge of the new Pratt Children's Library in Brooklyn. She was naturally good at her job and experimented with a lot of new ideas. And when the famous main branch of the New York Public Library was being built, you know, the one with the lions on the steps from all the movies, Anne Carroll Moore was asked to take charge of the new children's section. Kids really mattered to Anne, and she wanted them to feel welcome. So she installed kid-sized furniture, comfy seats in the windows for natural light, and the room was colorful. The walls were decorated for children. She always had fresh flowers to share. She felt that it was important that kids in the city got to be around the beauty of plants. So kids would often line up to take a big whiff of her freshest bouquet. Perhaps more important than the stuff and the nice-smelling whiffs to be had in the library were the near-constant story programs, puppet shows, and musical performances that Anne offered to patrons. Anne planned hundreds of events a year. Most often, kids would come to hear storytellers and readers take them on a journey around the world. And the world was also important to Anne. Just as it is today, New York City in the early 1900s was a melting pot of cultures and people and languages. and she didn't want any child to feel left out, so books were stocked in several languages. And some of the live story programs were in languages beyond English as well. She believed it was important to help a child be proud of the beautiful things about the country that their parents had come from. This kind of thinking was ahead of its time, and it was not a very common attitude. Another thing that mattered to Anne was respect. And for her, respect was a two-way street. It wasn't just kids respecting adults. When she hired a new librarian, they had to understand her guiding principles, the four respects.
Number one, respect for children. Number two, respect for children's books. Number three, respect for fellow workers. And number four, respect for the professional standing of children's librarians.
Perhaps her biggest early victory was convincing the library to allow children to check out books, which they did by signing their name in her gigantic ledger book, along with a pledge.
When I write my name in this book, I promise to take good care of the books I use at home and in the library, and to obey the rules of the library.
Within 2 years of opening the children's department, over 33%, or one-third of all of the books checked out from the New York Public Library, were kids' books. Clearly, the demand was there. And by allowing kids to check out books, it gave young people some control over their lives, the opportunity to learn more, and a new responsibility. Speaking of responsibility, Anne Carroll Moore grew to feel responsible for a lot of things. Particularly, books. As the head children's librarian of the main branch of the New York Public Library, she was in control of what titles the other branches kept on their shelves. Also, as so many other libraries around the country looked to the New York Public Library for guidance, her opinion essentially dictated what many other libraries added to their collection each year. She was sure to publish a list so everyone knew which books were Anne Carroll Moore approved. Her power grew, and maybe it went to her head a little bit. There's certainly people who would make that argument. But how could you not at least recognize your power when publishers would stop by to show you a new book before it was published, and they'd watch and hope with bated breath that you'd reach the end and tell them it was terrific? And if it wasn't, perhaps they'd go off to make the changes that you recommended. That's what happened to Anne. Of course, plenty of books were beyond help, or they never bothered checking with Anne in the first place. For these books, the books that did not meet her particular and rigid tastes for children's literature, she had a terrible gift. A fate worse than fire for any book. This gift, a big rubber stamp, would be inked and smacked on the paper to leave the book branded with the most terrible of curses. It would read, "Not recommended by expert." Anne Carroll Moore was the expert, and this was her final ruling. No ifs, ands, or buts.
"Get that book out of my face, and by all means, keep it away from any children."
You see, Anne liked her stories syrupy sweet. Tales that took children away from reality. She'd never sign off on a book that centered around things kids would see in their everyday lives. She'd never go for a book that focused on real-world problems. She'd probably never fall for a book with a less than happy ending, or at least an ending that left the reader with big questions. Straight and to the point, she wanted children to escape the world around them and find another, beautiful one in the pages of a book. She'd also never go for a book that didn't tell a traditional beginning, middle, and end type of story. Which is exactly what put her at odds with one very famous book. Anne Carroll Moore probably sealed the fate of more books than we can count, but one in particular stands out. Anne Carroll Moore is perhaps most famous for refusing to allow the book Good Night Moon on the library shelves. In fact, the New York Public Library didn't even put it on the shelves until 1975, which was 25 years after it was published. Something about a little rabbit slowly saying goodnight to everything in its bedroom just didn't click with Anne. Ultimately, though, her opinion didn't sway the public. Over 48 million copies of Margaret Wise Brown's book have been purchased since its debut. people have also loved other books that Anne rejected, including Charlotte's Web. But one has to wonder what works of art kids missed out on simply because Anne did not like them. Unlike the books that she preferred, her story is long and complicated. And actually, it also includes a little wooden doll named Nicholas Knickerbocker that she would use not only to talk to kids, but she also forced adults to talk to as if he were a real person. That's another matter, another story entirely, but it's still part of her story. Good or bad, Anne Carroll Moore shaped our idea of a children's library today. Anytime you go to a story time, or heck, even check out a book if you're under 14, you might owe her a slight debt of gratitude. I keep that in mind, and I appreciate it. But I make sure to read Goodnight Moon every so often. You know, just to make a point of my own. Hello, grown-ups. Do you need food? I need food. Do you like food? I like food. Yeah, we're all like that. Well, eating better is easy with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to go in just 2 minutes. You'll have 35 different options to choose from each week. Also, there are more than 60 add-ons to help you stay fueled up and feeling good all day long. The 2-minute meals are easy, so fuel up fast with Factor's restaurant-quality meals that are ready to heat and eat whenever you are. It's flexible for your schedule, too. Get as much or as little as you need by choosing your meals every week, and you can reschedule whenever you need to. Sign up and save. The math checks out. Factor is less expensive than takeout, and every meal is dietitian-approved to be nutritious and delicious. My wife and I have really been enjoying them. Actually, I think today I'm going to have some salmon piccata. I'm looking forward to it. So head to factormeals.com/curiouskids50 and use code curiouskids50 to get 50% off. That's code curiouskids50 at factormeals.com/curiouskids50 to get 50% off.
Are you looking for a podcast that your whole family can enjoy that asks the deep philosophical questions like, do trees fart?
If you are, then you'll love Tumble, a science podcast for kids. I'm Lindsay.
And I'm Marshall. Join us as we explore stories of science discovery, from butts to animals, dinosaurs, astronomy, and everything in between.
You'll love these stories, and you'll learn something new.
Find and follow Tumble Science Podcast for Kids wherever you get your podcasts, or at sciencepodcastforkids.com.
You Have 30 Seconds This Month comes from Calgary, Canada. Anders, take it away.
Hi, my name is Anders from Calgary, Canada. Jack Blount, born January 17th, 1929, in Quebec, Canada, changed hockey. He started playing hockey at 3 using only a tennis ball, a stick made from tree root, and stuffed potato sack pads, reinforced with wood. At 21, he joined the NHL and goal for the Montreal Canadiens. After breaking bones in his face 8 times, stopping pucks, he invented the face mask for protection. But his coach and him were in a real game. On November 1st, 1959, he broke his nose again and refused to play without a mask. The team went on to an 18-game winning streak and won the Stanley Cup for the 5th time. Today, all goalies wear face masks.
Whew, hockey pucks to the face. Jacques Plante, thanks for giving us the face mask. I'm sure goalies everywhere thank you. And I thank you, Anders, for sending that You Have 30 Seconds. I also hear that you got school credit for that because you also translated it into the French language. That's awesome. Glad I could help. If you have a 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 30 Seconds, all you need to do is send it via audio message, like on your voice memo recorder, to hello at the past and the curious. I'll take it from there. Well, okay, I guess now
It's quiz time. It's quiz time. It's quiz time. Time.
Here we are again at quiz time, and I've got some library questions that I'm gonna throw at you. Question number one. Those two lion sculptures that famously sit beside the staircase outside of the New York Public Library, they have names. Any idea what their names are? The two fierce feline figures were originally named Leo Astor and Leo Lennox after early library patrons John Astor and James Lennox. But in the 1930s, they were renamed, and they carry these names today. Patience and Fortitude. Okay, question number two. What or where, either answer will do, is the world's largest library? If you said something like Washington, D.C., you would be correct. And if you said the Library of Congress, you would be specifically correct, because that is the largest library in the world. There are over 173 million items in the catalog, which is a lot to keep up with. They've actually made progress in their collection because the original collection, about 3,000 items, was actually destroyed by fire during the War of 1812. Okay, I guess that would mean we're at question number three now. There is a library in Portugal where a few uninvited wild animals live. Mammals, in fact, just out in the open. Everybody's cool with it. What kind of animal lives in this Portuguese library? Well, if I would have said flying mammal, it might have given the answer away, because it's bats. Bats live in the Joanina Library. I hope I'm saying that correctly. Just out and about, these bats are. Librarians figure they eat bugs that might damage the book collection, so why not just let them be? They do make it a point to cover things with fabric each night so that the bat droppings don't damage anything. Good thinking. The man in charge of Central High School in Louisville, Kentucky, was fed up with the few resources that his students had in 1903. The high school students made do with his own personal collection of books for as long as they could, but they needed more. That man, Albert Mazzique, wasn't just an educator and school principal. He was a civil rights leader whose grandfather had played a role on the Underground Railroad. And Albert was seeing to the education of a group of African-American students in Louisville, a city that was highly segregated. White citizens and black citizens were not given the same accommodations and resources, and Mazzique and his black students were barred from using the new libraries that had just opened in the city. Mazzique found this to be unfair, because, well, it is unfair. For a short while, he negotiated to bring his students to the main branch of the public library anyway. They were granted an hour, and they had to use the back door. And eventually, enough people got mad that the deal was canceled altogether, and Mazzique and his students were once again not allowed. But he didn't stop. Along with a few people in his neighborhood, he agitated the city government, the library board, and others, and advocated for a library branch of their own. And in 1905, Andrew Carnegie, the millionaire doling out parts of his fortune for libraries, agreed to fund a new one in Louisville. The Western Library, as it is known, was the first public library in America for African Americans and the first to be run by African American librarians. Of course, at the time, there were no library training programs open to African Americans, so the staff had to learn on the job. As it turns out, the leaders of that library had amazingly brilliant, revolutionary ideas, which eventually made them a destination for other would-be librarians from around the country in search of a library education. More on that later. But now I must introduce you to the man with the vision, intelligence, and diligence to change his world from the steps of a library. His name was Reverend Thomas Fountain Blue, which is a name that is high in the running for my unofficial Coolest Names in History contest. Blue was born in Virginia in 1866, where both of his parents had been enslaved. Actually, his birthplace of Farmville is 31 miles away from Appomattox Courthouse. It was there, 11 months before the arrival of Baby Blue, that Confederate General Lee surrendered to General Grant, which effectively ended the Civil War and brought a legal end to slavery in the United States. Growing up after the war, Thomas Fountain Blue was well-educated. He attended a technical college and seminary, which led him as an adult to Louisville to run a branch of the YMCA in the largely black neighborhood known as Russell, the same neighborhood where Albert Mazzeek was working to get his students access to library books. It takes a while to build a library, but when it came to educating a community, there was no time to lose. So, while they waited on construction, the library existed in three rented rooms of someone's home. The big moment would come in 1908, though. The Western Library opened its doors, and the people who walked in found more than books. They found community. From the moment Western Library unlocked the door, it was a revolutionary place. The shelves were stocked with books of all sorts, including a complete collection of black authors. And both the librarians and patrons found inside the walls a place for people. There was a saying in America at this time. It had come from a legal ruling, an actual law, separate but equal. This meant black Americans and white Americans were not allowed to use the same spaces like schools, hospitals, or libraries. They were separated. But the law said these resources still had to be equal. In reality, they were not equal. Facilities, funding, nearly everything was very different. Facilities for African Americans were typically not as nice, nor as well furnished. But in many ways, the Western Library was an exception to the rule. The Western Library stood out as not just being separate and equal. In many ways, it was better than anything else in the city. And that's because of the work of people like Thomas Fountain Blue and his assistant, Rachel Harris. They believed libraries are for more than just books filled with facts. Libraries were a place that people could come together and build a better life, forge deeper ties to one another, and begin to make their world a better place. So together, Harris and Blue built a schedule of programs for the community. They offered space for meetings, they hosted debate nights, lectures, and more. These things might not sound thrilling to our ears now, but when you consider that in the 1910s we were decades away from mass media like TV and the internet, you might begin to see why this was so valuable to people eager to learn more about anything and everything. The building became the center point of a community, a place to discuss, share, learn, and yeah, read. And from the very beginning, Blue and Harris knew that kids should get attention and opportunities. Rachel Harris worked as the children's librarian, and just like Anne Carroll Moore in New York, she planned plenty of entertainment and education, music, performances, and of course, more story readings than you could shake a stick at. Even for a kid who wasn't yet reading, the library was a place to dive into a book. Another man, Joseph Seaman Cotter, was the principal of a nearby elementary school. And he also happened to be a writer, poet, and playwright who enjoyed some creative success and even hung out with people like Paul Laurence Dunbar. Well, Cotter loved a good story, which seems natural for an author, but he also wanted to share that love. So he began an annual event called the Cotter Cup, a competition of sorts that centered around the library's regular story times. Only for the Cotter Cup, the tables were turned. The kids told the stories. The idea to give kids this opportunity and power was pretty out-of-the-box thinking in the 1910s. As Cotter figured it, children who attended multiple story readings would have heard a whole bunch of different stories, and Cotter wondered how much they remembered of those stories. He also wondered how well they would do telling them themselves, and he also wondered how a kid might tell a story in a unique way and still include all of the details correctly. As much as he wondered, he and the library staff didn't wonder about one thing. They knew that it would be good for the children. And before long, the excitement of the competition grew. And not just because of the cool trophy and cash prize that Mr. Cotter ponied up each year for the winners. It was a new way to engage kids, instill confidence, and build a love of storytelling. So, naturally, other libraries adapted to this original idea. The Western Library was so successful that Thomas Fountain Blue was put in charge of a second branch on the eastern side of town, which opened up the need for more librarians. Meanwhile, with help from Carnegie's money, other libraries opened up across the country, similarly offering services to the African American communities in these other cities. And when they needed training or ideas, they looked to Thomas Fountain Blue and the Western Library. It became the training ground for Black librarians around the country. Where there had once been no educational training option, Thomas Fountain Blue and his team filled that need and trained dozens, if not hundreds, of people for jobs across the country. And in 1922, he spoke about this training program at the American Library Association Conference, making him the first African American to present at the ALA conference. Thomas Fountain Blue remained in charge of the branches until his death in 1935, at which time his friend Rachel Harris took on the role. In 1952, Louisville integrated all the libraries, making each one open to anyone. This was 12 years before the Civil Rights Act, which would outlaw discrimination of that sort in all of America. Through it all, the Western Library has remained a vital part of the community. However, in 2001, money was tight for the city and the library system, and as a result, there was a plan to close the Western Library. No pun intended, but out of the blue, or pun intended, maybe I should say out of the purple, a check for a lot of money showed up unexpectedly at the library. It was from the world-famous musician Prince. Some people call him the Purple One. He had no ties to the community, so people wondered why Prince had sent the money. But dig if you will. Maybe Prince understood the dearly beloved history of this institution and what it meant for the past, present, and future of the community. Someone who understands the history and importance of the library today is Natalie Woods. She is the branch manager of the Western Library today. And Natalie was a huge help in creating this story. I've been very fortunate to spend time with her over the years. As you might imagine, serving as the manager of this particular branch means a lot of things. Natalie sees to the library's day-to-day matters, but she's also the keeper of the archives and the history of the wildly historic space. And it's not something she takes lightly.
You know, I've spent a lot of time sitting and thinking about the weight of all these things that are I am now in charge of and the legacy that I am protecting and making sure that other people know about it. You know, the history of Cotter, you know, the things that Mazik and Blue and Rachel and all those kinds of things. I mean, I petitioned for over 4.5 years to get a headstone for Reverend Blue because he didn't have one. You know, and now he has one in Eastern Cemetery. And I thought that was the most terrible thing ever. I was like, how did they not have a headstone? Yeah. And now they do.
It's hard to understand why Reverend Thomas Fountain Blue's final resting place was unmarked for nearly 90 years. And it's certainly a shame that it happened. But the celebration around a new headstone, which even brought one of his descendants all the way from California, did give people an opportunity to revisit his importance and legacy. It gave everybody a chance to talk and learn about him once again. And recently, Natalie has also brought back the Cotter Cup in the form of an annual poetry contest. So it's easy to see that the past is not that far behind, and it still impacts so much of our lives today. It's important that we remember people like Cotter and Mazik and Blue and Rachel Harris, if for no other reason than because they worked hard for their community. And through that, they impacted communities far beyond their own. They are a good reminder that you never know what will happen if you just show up and do the work that needs to be done. Well, all right. Thank you so much for listening to episode 91 of The Past and the Curious. My name is Mick Sullivan, same as it was at the beginning of the episode, same as it will be at the beginning of the next episode. So, you know, I've got some people to thank, and I have a song for someone. But before we do that, I just want to bring up Boston again. If you are anywhere in the Northeast and you're going to be in Boston in April 20th, which is spring break in Boston, it's one of the weekends of spring break. Anyway, I am super excited. I'm going to be at WBUR, and I had so much fun last year, and I hope to see you. I'm really excited to be back. I'm going to have a fun time in the city, see some friends. I'm really looking forward to it. So I hope you can make it. And if not, there are virtual tickets. There's digital tickets that you can find on WBUR's website, the super awesome podcast playdate. The links are on my website, so you can find that. Anyway, let's get on with the thank yous. First off, Casey Curtis Markowitz in Portland, Oregon. Hello to you, and thank you for your support. I really, really appreciate it. It means a lot. And I have to say hello and thank you to Gilad Shoham in New Jersey. Hey, Gilad, I'm so glad that you enjoy the show, too. And, you know, maybe we'll bump into each other. Sometimes I make it to New Jersey. Who knows? Maybe you'll make it to Kentucky. I don't know. And Patricia Ann Cleary, the LBC, Long Beach, California. So thank you for your support. And with any of those people, if there's anyone that I should thank besides you, just send me a message and we'll do it in the next episode. If someone wants to hear their name, you just send me a Patreon message and we'll get it taken care of. Speaking of, there is a song that I have for the Gucci Gang. Whole family. They like to call themselves the Gucci Gang. Gucci's, thank you so much. I hope you enjoy your song. And I hope everyone else enjoys the spring. And I will talk to you very soon. Thank you for listening. My name is Mick Sullivan. Here comes the Gucci Gang.
Gucci, 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 Gucci. It's the Gucci. Gucci Gang. Why don't you scooch that thing? Make some room for the Gucci Gang. Jasper and Alma, Ira, Jasper, Alma, and Maple Pancake.
Friends, are you looking for a story time podcast with your littles? Something that has some great storytelling and maybe some conversation about it? Look no further. With Story Time with Philip and Mommy, my little guy Philip and I sit down every single day and read a story together. And we, of course, want you to join us. Grab your copy of the book, sit down, let's read it, and let's talk about it. We'll learn new words, we'll learn new ideas, and then we'll learn how we can use those stories in our lives. It's a lot of fun. Classics like Little Golden Books or Berenstain Bears, all the way up through the newest phenomenons like Bluey. We talk about them and we have a lot of laughs. It's a great time and we hope that you can come and join us. So please look for us and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Storytime with Philip and Mommy. Thanks so much. We'll see you there.
Have you ever wished that you had a direct line to your pediatrician to ask all the questions that constantly crop up while parenting? We sure have. That's why we launched the Bites of Health podcast. Every morning, we'll answer a commonly asked pediatric question in 5 minutes or less. You can tune in while you're making your second cup of coffee or from the school drop-off line. So be sure to tune in to Bites of Health, streaming now.